From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're taking a listen back to some of the best conversations we've had this year. Starting off, we head to the northwest corner of the state, where the California condor, one of the largest and rarest flying birds on the planet, once thrived on the West Coast. With 9-foot wingspans allowing them to soar up to 15,000 feet in the air, they could be seen from British Columbia to as far south as Baja California. But beginning in the 19th century, their numbers steadily declined and were nearly driven to extinction, before scientists captured the few remaining condors and saved the species through a captive breeding program. Today, there are about 330 condors in the wild and another 200 in captivity. Back in April, I spoke with Tiana Williams-Clausen, director of the Yurok Tribe's Wildlife Department, about not only an ecological milestone, but also how condors are a spiritual centerpiece for the Yurok people. I spoke with Tiana as they were preparing to release 4 condors over their ancestral lands for the first time in over 100 years. When did you first become fascinated with condors?
So my story is a little bit haphazard, I guess you might say. But I'm a Yurok tribal member. I grew up on the Yurok reservation and surrounding lands. And even as a young child, I knew that I wanted to give my life to serving the Yurok community. And there was a lot of ways that I could do that. For a long time, I thought I was going to be a doctor, actually went to school, got my degree at Harvard in biochemical sciences to be a doctor. But I got to the end of my senior year and I'm like, oh no, I don't want to be a doctor. But there was an opportunity that the tribe offers. They invest in their tribal youth by providing internships. And so after I graduated, I was offered an internship with our self-governance department, which is something like the State Department for Tribes. We work on co-management across the whole of Yurok ancestral territory to meet Yurok tribal needs. Now, that said, the self-governance department also coordinated what we called the Tribal Park Task Force, which was a panel of our elders specifically designated to prioritize natural and cultural resource restoration needs, because there was a lot of, unfortunately, destruction to our ancestral lands post-American contact, post-California Gold Rush. But they chose California condor Priganish as the single most important land-based species to bring back to Yurok ancestral territory. The last bird was seen around the turn of the 20th century, into the 20th century. Because of our deep cultural ties to the birds, as well as the ecological function that was no longer being filled by their absence. And so I went from a position with the self-governance department to actually the first employee of our newly crafted wildlife departments, which had California condor as its flagship species. And so that was in 2008 when the wildlife department got started, and we've been working towards California condor recovery ever since then.
Yeah. I mean, and California condors are just one example of a species that was driven nearly to extinction because of humans. But if you can explain to us, like, specifically when it comes to California condors and Northern California, and they haven't been seen in the skies for over 100 years, what led to the disappearance from that region?
Unfortunately, as is often the story, it was largely human-caused problems for them. They had been relatively abundant in our region. As you'd mentioned, they went all the way up to British Columbia at one time. But with the huge influx of more people, there's just a lot more human impact. So, for example, there was direct take of condors, which is very hard on the species. They are a long-lived, they can live as much as 60 to 70 years, but slow-producing species. So if you have high mortality but low reproduction, that's, you know, what causes extinction. So there's direct harvest or killing of them for science or out of fear of them. There was people laying out poisoned carcasses for other species that they had concerns over, like wolves or bears, and the condors would eat them and die. As you referenced, condor story is not a unique one. There was a lot of over-harvest of the foods that they relied on. So the large game, like elk and deer and California sea lion and whales, so they didn't have the food resources to continue to persist. And there was the introduction of new and toxic chemicals. Two of them that remain an issue today are lead contamination, which has been implicated through the use of lead ammunition. It's a soft material and fragments heavily upon impact, which probably isn't too much of a problem for most adult humans, but for condors and other scavengers like eagles, you know, a piece as small as the head of a pin can kill one of these animals. And so it will break into hundreds of pieces, get into a gut pile, a hunter will leave the gut pile behind, which is normally good food for a scavenger, but not when contaminated with lead. And that's actually caused something like 50% of known mortality for condors in the wild, even today, in most recent years. So that was introduced. The other chemical is DDT, which we know causes eggshell thinnings and remains a problem for condors in some places where they're using a lot of coastal resources. So these things can be addressed. For example, that we stopped using DDT in our environment, and it's only going to be a downward trend from there. And there's been a lot of support from the hunting community to transition to non-lead ammunition, which is non-toxic for these birds. But they definitely had their impact and unfortunately continue to have their impact in certain areas.
Yeah, especially since the Yurex relationship with these birds goes back to the beginning of time. Can you tell us more about the history of this relationship and the condor's cultural and spiritual significance to Yurok people?
Definitely. So I think to start, as you say, you got to start with the beginning of time. It's always hard for me to be brief because you have to start with the beginning of time for most stories. But even before humans were really what we consider to be the people of the world, the spirits or the animals were the people of the world. And it was from them that we learned how to manage the world and keep it in balance. And so one of the ways that we do this is through our world renewal ceremonies. We actually consider ourselves to be world renewal people. That's our foundational reason for existing, to keep the world in balance and healthy. But back in the beginning of time, it was species like the condor who helped develop these ceremonies that we continue to engage in today, providing us prayers, providing us parts of our regalia. Condor, particularly, we believe, ecologically speaking, he actually flies higher than any other species in the entire world, or in the entire North America, excuse me. And so we believe that he carries our prayers over the world when we're asking for the world to be in balance. So he is very foundational to our reason for being. So not having him here as a part of our ecological community has been very difficult because it's hard to maintain a relationship with someone who's been gone for well over 100 years. And that's largely what drove us to start this initiative.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And this initiative, as you mentioned, began over a decade ago. You've personally been working on this since you were interning as an undergrad. And the expected release of these California condors has made state and even national headlines. It must be such a special moment. What does this moment mean for you?
It is incredible. I mean, there's just been so much. I mean, there's obviously my heart is too full to even possibly describe. The first time, because we actually have the birds up in Humboldt County, as you mentioned. So the first day that they were there, there was lots of gritting. There was lots of tears. I didn't get very excited. I'm going like this, like wiggling my hands and stuff. But there's just so much love for them in the community as well, which has just completely buoyed us up and kept us going for the last 14 years. And of course, condors themselves are so iconic when it comes to terms of endangered species conservation and saving them, really. So this has just been a huge deal for so many people. And one of the things that I love about condors, not only themselves, but is just how much love people have for them and how they bring people from so many diverse walks of life together in support of such incredible conservation movements.
Yeah, they're majestic. And I mean, when our producer Nick brought up this story and reached out to you, I mean, we all got super excited about it. So it definitely has ripple effects beyond Northern California and Humboldt County. In addition to the sacred and spiritual role that condors play, you know, they're also a piece of the ecosystem. Can you tell us more about the role that California condors have in the ecosystem and why it's so crucial and important?
So California condor are an obligate scavenger, as we say. They only eat dead carcasses on the landscape versus something like an eagle, which can both, you know, kill food itself and scavenge for food. Now, that said, we do have our local scavengers. We do currently have our turkey vultures and our common ravens, but they're, compared to condors, relatively small. The ecological niche that condor fills is being able to really start the decomposition process for the very large animals that they like to feed on. So again, that's the elk and the deer, California sea lions and whales that otherwise have a hard time to start getting broken down in our system. So, you know, me, I live on the coast. I do a lot of beach walking. It's very common that you'll walk along the beach and you'll see these large, really honestly disgusting bloated California sea lion carcasses, not to be too indelicate there. But condors go in and they break through that tough skin, that thick blubber that smaller animals can't, not only feeding themselves, but also decomposing the animal and making the food more bioavailable to other scavengers to eat.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Tiana Williams-Clausen, the director of the Yurok Tribe's Wildlife Department, sharing efforts to return the California condor to tribal lands after a 100-year absence. So let's get to the big question. Can you tell us when you think these condors will be released?
I can tell you very soon. It's a little bit of a biological complexity. These are young birds. They're 2 and 3 years old. We have 4 birds who will be releasing, 1 female and 3 males. They are full size. They're full grown, but they're still considered juveniles. And they came from the captive rearing facility. So they've actually never been out in the wild. So we're looking for a particular set of environmental factors to release them into. So one is the appropriate sort of weather. So some decent wind, but not a ton of wind because it's going to be the first time they're flying out on their own. Some good sun. We'll also be looking for a time when our other local scavengers are nearby the release facility where they're currently being held so that we can release them out into a flock of turkey vultures or ravens. They're very social birds with each other, but also with the rest of the avian scavenger guild. So we're looking for a time that kind of meets a multiplicity of environmental needs, but also making sure that the birds seem ready to go out themselves, that they're happy and healthy and ready to jump out. So hopefully within the next 2 to 3 weeks, though I don't have a specific day that it's going to happen yet.
Well, that's like 14 years in the making. So 2 weeks is like a snap of the fingers, right? Or a blink relatively. am I correct? Do these 4 birds, do they currently share a pen with a mentor bird?
They do. We have a mentor bird, 746. He actually came from the Boise World Center of Birds of Prey, who have been, I mean, they're managed by the Peregrine Fund, who have been an awesome partner. All of the California condor recovery managers and treatment facilities and breeding facilities have been amazing partners. But so we bring in a mentor bird who is an adult bird because he can help kind of finish off the condors, I guess you might say, and teach them really those last touches of appropriate condor social behavior, which is really beneficial to them when they're out in the wild because they are very communal, they are very social, and they rely on each other to do well. So he's kind of finishing them off, teaching them the last things that they need to know. He won't be released, unfortunately. He's staying with us probably for the first and probably the second cohort of birds that we'll receive as well, after which he'll return to the Boise World Center of Birds of Prey to help contribute to the breeding population. But for now, he's just a great asset, and we're so grateful to have him.
You know, once the birds are released, obviously your work isn't complete, and there are still challenges that these 4 condors will face. What is the next phase of your research, and what do you hope to learn?
Well, we just hope to learn what the birds teach us, honestly. It's been a very long time since they've been on the landscape, and while we do have traditional knowledge about how they use that landscape, this is a particularly unique situation in that it's the first new release area in 19 years, I think, almost 20 years. And all of our birds are going to have just the top technology for tracking them in the field. So this will be, the first release where we'll really be able to extensively monitor how a new reintroduction like this kind of plays out, like almost on an hourly sort of basis, because our satellite tags give us an hourly ping for everything that the birds do. So I'll be watching to see how they navigate a new state, a new place, not having another condor flock to integrate into, which thankfully through their hard work at other release sites, condors who are released do have an old flock to integrate into. So they're basically the pioneers here of Yurok ancestral territory. And I'm just going to be really interested to see how they adapt and expand into our landscape.
Yeah, given that this is so groundbreaking and going back to the beginning of time, how have your elders and ancestors helped shape this journey?
This has been entirely their doing. I mean, obviously the Yurok tribe, all tribes went through a very hard time and us no less. We were forced off of our lands. Our children were taken to the boarding schools where it was illegal to speak your language or practice your culture or wear your traditional clothing or anything. Our ceremonies were illegal until the 1970s. And so it's really incredible that we're still here to tell our story. But I'm just always amazed by the, I don't know, just the powerful hearts that maintained these cultural connections despite the absence of Condor, despite all the pressures on us as a human population. And so I really feel incredibly blessed by our elders who kept that knowledge, who kept that relationship, who maintained it until the world evolved to a place where people like me could pick it up and make changes like this. So this never would have happened without them. We've definitely had our elders out to meet the birds and just, I can't put into words how amazing that felt, how much gratitude they had for meeting the birds. I always put the honor to them, but it's the Yurok way to be grateful. And so I just really appreciate their gratitude for the work that we're doing. And I just feel like we're in a really amazing place and there's just only awesome things to come from here.
Yeah. You and these condors are healing generational harm, really.
We are. I think restoration of Preganish, which is the Yurok word, really means restoration of the Yurok people and our entire system.
Tiana Williams-Clausen is the director of the Yurok Tribe's Wildlife Department, sharing her efforts to return the California condor to her tribal lands after a 100-year absence. Since our conversation first aired in April, at least a half dozen condors have been released over Yurok land. Up next, we learn about the history of lowrider culture, now experiencing a revival of participation, leadership, and representation. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're revisiting some of the best conversations we've had this year, which brings me to low and slow. Lowrider culture has been around for decades in California and more broadly the Southwest. But recently, there's been a push from lowrider car clubs to reevaluate the intention, effectiveness, and harm of anti-cruising ordinances across the state. Earlier this year, the Sacramento City Council joined a larger shift and repealed its ban on cruising, put back in place in the 1980s. Back in June, I talked with Chicano Studies professor Denise Sandoval, based at California State University, Northridge, who has long worked to promote, highlight, and bring awareness to the lowrider cultural movement, which is currently experiencing a revival of participation, leadership, as well as representation by women of color. All right. Well, Professor Sandoval, when the topic of low-riding culture and anti-cruising ordinances has been picking up steam across the state, but let's start from the beginning. How did low-riding culture, this movement, originate? Where did it start from?
Well, low-riding really emerged after World War II, right? And so when there was that sort of boom in post-World War II, car culture, right? And there became this sort of fascination with cars and drag racing, right? Demolition derbies, cruising, all that period that we see as like the heart of Americana, right? And what it sort of means to be American, right? And on the weekends, right? Sort of enjoying your car and your community. But if we go back a little bit further, really the roots of car custom culture begin with hot rodding that began a lot earlier in the late 1930s, you know, Southern California that gave birth to hot rod culture, right? Was really about sort of car customizing, you know, drag racing, right? So that was really the first culture that really sort of customized and modified cars. And a lot of the top builders and painters were out here in Southern California. And I think the other thing about Southern California is just the weather. You know, we have to talk about how the weather is also so conducive to car culture and cruising and people enjoying their cars on the weekends at the park. So I always like to say, like, where hot rodding was about built for speed, right? They were raising their cars from the back, and it was about going fast. Lowriders were oppositional aesthetics, so they took it low to the ground and was about going slow. But what I always like to tell my students is the fascinating thing is how we use culture to build identity, right? So for me, when I was young, lowriding, I grew up in La Puente, and so lowriding was really big in La Puente. My family did not come from lowriders. My family roots are actually East Los Angeles and Lincoln Heights. So lowriding was something that was always in my community, but I think it was when I went to college and found an old issue of Lowrider magazine from the 70s in one of the libraries, and I started to think about how cars are the way that we tell our American story. It's how we express what it means to be Mexican Americans. And again, I have to mention that, you know, Chicanos did not originate lowriding. You know, it's also part of that birth culture. Like when you look at LA, there were African Americans lowriding, white guys lowriding, right? So I think Chicanos just have become synonymous with sort of the popular image of what is lowriding through media. And I would also argue that it's probably the Chicano culture within lowriding is also kept alive with that history with the pachucos. And, you know, here we are in June and there is a wedding or a quinceanera happening at this time where instead of limos, using lowriders, instead of traditional tuxedos, they're wearing the zoot suit. So I think it particularly, right, how aesthetics and style becomes a way of cultural resistance for Mexican-American communities that really began with the zoot suit generation that, again, took a fashion style from African-American culture.
Yeah, it becomes a part of identity. Where do you see the problems in terms of this becoming, in terms of stereotyping low-riding culture, especially since it's been around for decades?
Well, I think, you know, we sort of just ended with the zoot suit. Like I always like, you know, I'm a historian, right? So I always tell my students, we got to trace, right? So I think if you sort of think about how the zoot suit in the 40s became criminalized, right? And you have to think about, well, the issue was because black and brown bodies were wearing the zoot suit, right? At a time of World War II, where there was supposed to be this war rationing on materials. But I think the other side that we don't talk about is that zoot suit culture was a way to bring pride of what it meant to be black, what it meant to be brown in a time period where there was housing discrimination, there was prejudice, right? There was school segregation. So it was a way of people of color using, right, an American product, right, a fashion style, but making new meaning out of it, right? So like a sense of pride. So I think that was another part, right, is that you're being extravagant, right, flamboyant. And I think that's something that it shares with low riding, right? Because hot rodding too, it's like you want people to look at your car or look at your body, right? If you're wearing a zoot suit, because you want to be seen. And what did that mean? That power of being seen at a time period that we're talking about where there is discrimination and racism in many black and brown communities in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, right? That I'm talking like sort of the pre sort of civil rights movements for particularly Angelenos. So I think that's the other side, right? Is that these sort of laws and policies come out of a larger infrastructure that already looks at black and brown communities in a negative way, right? So I think when we sort of think about the stereotype of lowriding as gangs on wheels, you know, a lot of that is part of that historical trajectory. And a lot of the anti-cruising ordinances that you look at on the books, and I'm just looking at California in particular, you know, are really birthed in a time period in the 80s and 90s when a lot of cities were dealing with gangs, right? And sort of turmoil in the urban cities. So, you know, I think a lot of the anti-cruising ordinances went hand in hand with some of the gang injunctions. But I think at this period that we are today, is that lowriders are, you know, contributing to their cities. You know, they're, I think one of the things that people don't realize about lowriders is they're very philanthropic. They're very active, right, in helping their community. Like the oldest lowrider car club in Los Angeles is the Dukes, and they come out of South LA, and they grew up in South LA when it was primarily Black, and it's the Ruelas brothers. And so they would talk about at a young age that they always learned about giving back to their community. And so, you know, in the 70s, they were doing car shows, you know, for Boys and Girls Club. They were doing car shows for Mecha at UCLA or at ELAC. So they were also part of the Chicano movement. And I think that's a history that people do not realize, right? That it, yes, it's about having a beautiful car, right? Cruising the boulevard, hanging out with your car club. But the way in which clubs have also contributed to improving the lives of their community and assisting their community. And even today, if I think about some of the strongest communities of activism, you know, I have to look at like San Diego, Barrio Logan, right? That goes back to sort of Chicano Park, where they were fighting, right, to maintain this land that was promised to them, right, for a park. San Francisco at the Mission, you know, where those lowriders actually sued the city in 1980 because of racial profiling of cruising. And so that was probably one community that works with the police and they don't have severe cruising injunctions, but they've organized like cruising vaccination drives during COVID, you know, food banks, San Jose, which is also very active, you know, fighting for their community. If there's an erasure of a Chicano mural in that community, there's the Lowrider Club speaking in front of the city council. So I think that history is one people aren't aware of, that yes, lowrider clubs are fighting anti-cruising ordinances, but all these other communities, interesting enough, I see it more outside of LA. And, you know, as an Angeleno, I'm like, oh my God, we have so much power here. We should organize to do this larger work, right? Infrastructure work. But I think those are one of the things in understanding anti-cruising ordinances is thinking about they were created for a certain purpose and time period. And today, let's reevaluate that, right? Is it really, you know, that dangerous, right, or that nefarious for our communities? And there's a way to sort of work with law enforcement to create safe cruising events. And I'm sure you're aware that, like, I think it was just approved the other day. I was looking at it in the California Assembly, Luz Rivas, who's the
right. There's a bill moving through the state capitol.
Yeah. And so I was like, you know, I'm not like a Miss Politics person, so I know it was like passed, right? But it was like something on the calendar. But I think what's interesting is it's overall a statement about sort of recognizing the contributions of lowrider culture to California that I think it's going to need some sort of larger bill that sort of outlaws, right, cruising.
Yeah. So that bill that you're talking about, it's a resolution that would encourage the culture and for local law enforcement to work with car clubs to have safe cruising events, as you just kind of laid out. And it's now moving to the full assembly. And this is really just the latest. Even here in Sacramento, the city of Sacramento recently rescinded an anti-cruising ordinance. This isn't the only city in California to do this in maybe the past year or even in recent years. Is this something that has just been building momentum? What strikes you about the fact that this is now moving from conversations, you know, within communities to actually moving into city and potentially state resolutions and law?
It's exciting for me, right? Because on one hand, I've been one of those strong advocates whenever I speak and in my work about that lowriding has a lot to teach us about how to build community, how to use culture to express identity. And again, like when you think about in all my years of over 22 years of interviewing lowriders, and when you talk to the people that lowride and you ask them, what does it mean to be a lowrider? They always say, you know, family, right? Community, corazón, heart, right? Hard work, carnalismo, brotherhood, which I would also add sisterhood, you know, today with the entrance of women in larger numbers into the car scene. So I think the lowriders already see themselves in one way, right? And I think it's the broader culture, right? Popular media and how it's sort of stigmatized lowriding. So it's really exciting for me to see this, right? Because it's this recognition that you know, low riding is an important cultural expression for people of color in California, that it contributes a lot to, you know, Southern California culture as well. If you think about, you know, the people in Japan, right, they're modeling themselves on California low riding.
Right across the Pacific.
Yeah, like New Mexico, well, Española, New Mexico is the self-proclaimed low rider capital of the world. New Mexico is low riding has been sort of integrated into sort of the state's image of what is New Mexico. You know, at the Albuquerque airport, they actually had low riders and low rider bicycles there for close to a year. And I was thinking, like, Los Angeles, LAX would never do that. So I always look at New Mexico as sort of an example of a state of like using, yes, they use that culture for cultural tourism, but what it does is it elevates, right, these cultural spaces and says they're American, right? There's something beautiful about them. And it's encouraging, obviously, tourism to sort of look at, just like looking at Native American pottery or basket weaving, right? They're also saying low riding is part of New Mexican culture. So I think that validation is so important because it's recognizing that our culture matters, that our culture is American. And like I always argue, I think that low riding has a lot to teach people about American culture, about building community, because when you're in the low riding community, it's not about the color of your skin or where you grew up. It's the love of cars that brings people together and builds community. And in that community, there are discussions, right, about culture and race and class, right? So you are learning about each other, about our communities. And that's so beautiful, right? When they always talk about low riding is a movement, or the lowrider family. It's not just California, it's the larger national landscape. So I think like all of these things are very important, right? Because they're all part of what this sort of assembly bill is trying to get at, right? And it also educates people about lowriding.
And what you're also touching upon is a validation of lowrider culture that really transcends a regional community, even the state, even the country. I mean, you were talking about Japan and having a lowrider culture thrive there. There's also Disney movies such as Cars, and also it's a staple in hip hop music. But actually going within the movement, how has it changed in recent decades? You briefly touched upon the growing movement of women forming clubs. Talk to us about that. How has that grown?
So women have always been a part of lowrider culture. And even in the older car clubs, you know, there were women that, you know, had lowriders, were solo riders, or had lowriders with, you know, their husbands or their partners. So women have always been a part of lowriding. But I think like when I began my interviews, I remember hearing like from lowrider clubs, I'm only speak of Los Angeles, right? Because that's kind of where my research started, was that, you know, the clubs were like, oh, we don't want women, you know, women will cause problems, right? But what I see the change, like really in this last 5 to 8 years, and I really think it's like, they were younger men when I met them. So my gen, like Gen X, I think as they've had daughters and just the US culture has shifted with the like girl power, women can do what they want, right? And so, as I said, women have always been there, right? And we've always sort of participated in the culture. But now there's just all these women car clubs springing up in California, like the Dueñas, right? The Chingonas down here in LA. Up north, there's one called Chicana Car Club. And so it's been like amazing to see women sort of being, to me, I see them as the leaders and the future of lowriding, right? Because as we were saying about like, you know, lowrider car clubs have always been participating in the community. But I think when we look at the longer history of Chicana activism, it has been Chicanas, Mexican-American women that have really moved our culture, right? Because this notion of like, you know, women as nurturers, but women as caring about their community and neighborhood and taking on larger issues that maybe the community, you know, I'm talking about things like gender issues, right? And family issues. So I'm really excited to see sort of where that next chapter is. And even like dealing with, you know, Chicano queer community, Chicanx, right? So I think like all of these changes of how the culture and where we're at, it's really beautiful for me. And I'm excited and inspired by to see that next chapter as the community sort of moves low riding forward.
Well, before we let you go, let's get to a next chapter. There's currently work being done at the Smithsonian, and you are a part of that. Talk to us about that and how that's taking shape and what it will look like.
So I'm working with the Smithsonian to build a traveling exhibition of low riding. It will be mostly images because it's too expensive, right, to tour Making objects across the United
vehicles,
States.
Vehicles, yes.
Vehicles. But so we're building photos, right, that will tour the United States with the Smithsonian traveling exhibition, which is called Sights. And they've had successful exhibitions, like there's one touring right now with Dolores Huerta, and they have a baseball one that's touring, and their most popular one was the one on Bracero. So these, it'll travel the United States. And so the hope is, like, if it goes to Denver, Colorado, you know, if it goes to Chicago, like, that museum, that cultural center, that space can include the local lowrider community, right, and bring objects that way. So it's, you know, I'm really honored to be working on this. You know, when I started this, you know, I was in my 20s, and I just knew that, you know, these stories needed to be told and of my community in Los Angeles. And I really saw that low riding is such a beautiful cultural expression, and it really speaks to the tensions of what it means to be Mexican American in our histories and in the present. So I think, like, an exhibit like this will take it to a larger stage, right? A larger conversation. And it's exciting to see. We're still some time out because Smithsonian, it takes time, right, to build these exhibitions. So we're looking at maybe late 2024, early 2025. But also part of this project, because of the pandemic, sort of put, you know, a stop to some of the work, like it did for a lot of museums. So I did oral history. So I went to, like, the Bay Area, San Diego, Phoenix, New Mexico, and was interviewing lowriders in those communities. So it's been exciting for me to take my work outside of Los Angeles and to really hear the voices of, you know, low riding across the United States.
Well, thank you so much. And you know, 2024, 2025 will be here before you know it.
And I know.
Thank you so much, Professor Sandoval. You know, just sharing a piece of not only Southern California history, but California history.
Yes, thank you for the invitation.
That is my conversation with Chicano Studies Professor Denise Sandoval at California State University Northridge about the history of lowrider culture. Our conversation first aired in June. Still ahead, Cap Radio's Gary Vercelli sits down with legendary jazz pianist Michael Wolff on the heels of his autobiography, On That Note. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're rounding out a special hour of Insight, listening back to some of the most meaningful conversations this year. Our final piece comes from Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, who sat down with Michael Wolff back in June, a critically acclaimed pianist with a rich musical history. Wolff recently published an autobiography, On That Note, sharing an incredible career as well as a profound joy for living following a serious health scare.
In 1974, at the young age of 22, pianist Michael Wolff was already a member of the Cannonball Adderley Quintet, one of the most famous bands in jazz. Wolff went on to work with jazz legends Sonny Rollins and Nancy Wilson before becoming the music director for the Arsenio Hall Show. In his recently published autobiography, On That Note, Wolf describes the highs and lows of the jazz life, as well as his struggles with undiagnosed Tourette's syndrome as a child and a rare form of cancer that nearly took his life as an adult. Through it all, Michael Wolf emerges as a pianist and educator with a positive attitude and a joy for living. Wolf grew up in New Orleans in Memphis, studying piano and soaking up the sounds of African-American churches. As a youngster, he started to experience what he called tics.
We moved to Berkeley, California in 61, and nobody there ever told me I had Tourette's syndrome, and I just grew up not knowing what it was. I just thought it was my habits, and I thought it was my problem, that I just shouldn't have it, and if I could just figure some things out, be maybe a better person or whatever, it would go away. I was really ashamed of it, you know, all these different tics, and I started making some noises, you know, and it wasn't until years later, when I was in my early 30s, a friend of mine, my sister-in-law was a social worker, and I was hanging out with her, and she said, "Hey, do you know you have Tourette's syndrome?" And I said, "What do you mean I have Tourette's syndrome? I don't have Tourette's syndrome. What is that?"
As you'll hear a bit later, Michael Wolf would face a very serious health challenge that would eclipse his concern with Tourette's. While he was still a student at UC Berkeley in the early 70s, Michael got a job transcribing lead sheets at Fantasy Records. That led to a meeting with a jazz legend that would launch his career into high gear.
I just walked around Fantasy and I looked in this room and there was Cal Jader, and I had seen him when I was in college. And so I just walked in and said, "Hey, my name is Mike Wolf. I'm a piano player and I'm ready to play in your band." And he looked kind of shocked and he said, "Well, I'm going to be playing in San Francisco at El Matador this summer. Why don't you come and sit in?" That was so far before the summer, I basically spaced it out. Just went, okay, you know, I didn't think it was going to happen. But my roommate told me, he said, "Hey, man, you got to go see Cal. He's at the El Matador, and he told you to come sit in." So I went over there, but I wasn't 21. You had to be 21 to get in the club. So I went every night, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. They would never let me in. And finally on Sunday, this beautiful waitress took pity on me and snuck me in. And on the very last set, Cal let me sit in, and I played really well. And he said, "Look, I want you to come back next week and play with me all week." And after that, he said, "Yeah, I've got a gig in a month, and we're going to go to Tucson, and we're going to be there for 2 weeks. You got the gig."
Invited Cannonball Adderley to hear him play in Jader's band in a club in Los Angeles, and Cannonball liked what he heard. In 1974, an opening occurred, and Cannonball offered Wolf another great opportunity. Wolf was a generation younger than every member of Cannonball's quintet and the only Caucasian in the band, but they all spoke the common language of jazz.
He told me, he said, "Man, I hired you because you're not hung up in a bebop style." He said, "Quincy Jones and I have been trying to get that last foot out of Birdland." And he really wanted to play different music. And, you know, I'd come up playing jazz, but also funk and Latin. I had my electric piano and I had a lot of pedals and I could get a lot of sounds out of it. So he was very, very encouraging to me. And he said, "Look, man, I love the way you play. Don't let anybody tell you what to play." You know, he really supported me. And in terms of off the bandstand, I once talked to Cannonball about it, and he liked to talk to the audience. He said, "If you get to know the audience and you let the audience get to know you as a person, you can take them wherever you want to go as a musician." So I always talk to my audience. I'm pretty funny. You know, I like to include them in my whole performance, and I think I owe that to Cannonball.
After Cannonball's untimely death, Mike spent 5 years touring the world as Nancy Wilson's music director. The opening act for many of those shows featured a largely unknown comic named Arsenio Hall. Mike and Arsenio really hit it off.
He said, one day I'm going to have a talk show and you're going to write the theme and do the music. And I went, okay, man, I'm up for it. So when he got his show, I didn't know if it was going to last. I figured it might last 13 weeks. So I didn't buy a car. I just sublet a friend's apartment for a few months. And it just turned into a 5.5 years. And it changed my life. It was the first time I'd really made any money. And I got to play with everybody, you know, jazz, greats like Herbie Hancock and Branford Marsalis and Wayne Shorter and, you know, so many greats, Chick Corea. And it was my band, so I really had a great position with them, you know, dealing with them. And I got to play with Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey and her first thing when she was about 18. It was on the job training in a lot of ways. And the best thing that came out of it is there was an actress that I had always liked who was a star of 30-something named Polly Draper. She came on the show, and I made it a point to meet her. And eventually I asked her out, and now we've been married for 30 years, and we have 2 sons. That was a life-changing experience for me.
When the Arsenio show was canceled, Mike wasn't happy about it, but he wasn't devastated either. He was already scoring for film and TV, and it gave him the opportunity to return to the jazz world.
Jazz is playing between the lines. You know, it just fits my Tourette's personality. You know, I don't have to be exact. I don't have to be trying to be perfect. I can be really creative, and that's what I missed.
Back in New York City, Wolf formed a partnership with veteran drummer Mike Clark. The Wolf and Clark Expedition released 2 critically acclaimed albums, putting their original stamp on jazz standards and offering some straight-ahead originals like Michael Wolf's composition, Clark Bar. About this time, Wolf began feeling ill and was diagnosed with a type of lymphoma. He underwent treatment for 1 year, but his health continued to decline. The doctors then discovered he'd been misdiagnosed and actually had a rare form of cancer called histiocystic sarcoma, a cancer so rare only 300 people had ever had it.
There was no cure for that at the time, and the doctor said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't know what to do. I'm going to send you to the rare cancer guy. It is Memorial Sloan Kettering. They're way ahead of the curve. They do lots of experimental things. And they had a experimental genomic blood test that they did. Just look at your DNA and see if they can find a mutation that might cause whatever cancer you happen to have. That was really my only hope because it was stage 4 and the doctor thought I had about 3 months left. You know, I was really sick. It took 6 weeks for all of the DNA to come in for that test. And as it was coming in, the doctor was just getting more and more discouraged. And he told my wife, he said, I'm stumped. At the very end, a mutation came in that he thought might be my cancer. So he went into the lab himself, checked it out with my biopsy and thought, yeah, maybe that'll do it. So he went on the computer and found a tiny little pill that looks like nothing. And that's used for something else. And he said, let's try it. And I did. And after 2 days, all my symptoms went away. And then in 10 days, I had 80% reduction of tumors. I took that medicine for a couple of years. After the first 6 months, he wasn't seeing any cancer. And he said, I just don't see any cancer. And I said, well, how would I know if I'm cured? He goes, you'd have to stop the medicine. So I stopped the medicine. He said, if you go 1 year without it coming back, it's not in remission. You're cured. So it's been almost 4 years now.
Wolf now teaches at NYU and continues to record and perform around New York. I asked him how his bout with cancer changed his life.
Couple of different things. One, I try every day to notice something really special. If I'm in New York, I look up to see a building I wouldn't have normally looked at, or the sunset, or, you know, something like that. Write a song. Whatever I do, I can't say I achieve that every day, but I want to try to do that every day. And the main thing I decided, or that I came to from this experience, the gift that I got from it, was to realize that the absolute most important thing for me in my life is my family, and then after that, the people I love. And the people I love that are no longer alive, you know, they're really important to me. I realize they're kind of living with me all the time, and I accept that, you know, whether it's Cannonball or Cal Jader or Miles Davis or my parents, who are both deceased.
I asked Michael Wolff if he ever felt like giving up.
I think I have a basic, realistic optimism in myself, and I found out through this experience that my character is very strong. I really wanted to survive, and I just wasn't gonna quit no matter what. There's something inside of me, unconscious or instinct or whatever it is, that wasn't gonna let me just, you know, call it. I just couldn't do it.
Michael Wolff's autobiography is titled On That Note.
That is Cap Radio jazz music director Gary Vercelli, who sat down with pianist Michael Wolff about his memoir, On That Note. Their conversation first aired back in June. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.